The new Presidential Religious Liberty Commission had its first meeting this week. What does it consider the most outrageous threat to religious liberty? Commission Chair and Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, is here to tell us. George Weigel is here with reaction to the latest news from Pope Leo XIV in Rome, and he shares his new book. And defense and counterterrorism expert John Rossomondo discusses the current state of the growing conflict between Iran and Israel. Will the U.S. be drawn in? The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you would like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo, also at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. In May, President Donald Trump established a Religious Liberty Commission, its primary goal to protect the free exercise of religion here in the United States. To discuss all of this and more, I'm joined by the Lieutenant Governor of the great state of Texas, Chair of the Religious Liberty Commission, Dan Patrick. Lieutenant Governor, thank you for being here. You are the first chairman of this Religious Liberty Commission. First off, tell me, what do you see as the greatest threat to religious liberty? What did you hear at the meeting?
So, Raymond, thank you for having me. Our longtime friendship. It's great to be on with you. Sure. The biggest threat to religious liberty, twofold. One, the courts. And two, apathy by those people of faith. Because if you don't fight for it, you can lose it, whatever it is in life. And I talked in the committee in my opening remarks about the book of Jude, where Jude says we must contend earnestly. And that was when he was sending the message to the church then, that in essence, in today's language, you have to fight for your faith and be wary of those who come and try to undermine your faith and undermine the church. And so when I talked to the president about this last November, and he had already talked about religious liberty in his first 4 years, I said, I think the timing is right now. And he just loved the idea. And I give all the credit to the president. With everything that's been going on, he kept singular focus on, we're going to make this happen. And I just have the greatest committee of people, the greatest witnesses. And I hope people, they can go to danpatrick.org and hear it. It's about 5 hours long. You hear it a little bit at a time. And you'll learn so much about what our founders intent, what the Establishment Clause is about, and so much more, and how we lost it in this country through court decisions, basically after World War II up until really kind of the current Trump court.
Yeah, we've seen a contraction of that constitutional right to religious liberty. The commission met for the first time on Monday at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. Among the members in attendance, Bishop Robert Barron, Dr. Phil McGraw, Dr. Ben Carson, who's vice chair, and many others. Dan, what were the standout moments in your estimation?
So the standout moments were how we came together as a committee, because when I spoke in the Rose Garden back on National Prayer Day, when the president announced the executive order for the Commission on Religious Liberty, I said I felt like a pair of brown shoes in a room full of tuxedos. And that's the truth. I know a lot about history. I know a lot about the Bible. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm surrounded by people who have spent their whole life in dealing with religious liberty. And so I had the most to learn, and I learned the most, Raymond. And so what stood out to me was how well our committee worked together. Most of us all came together 30 minutes before the committee, because all of these people have such outstanding schedules and commitments. Yeah. And so we came together, and we made it a conversation. The witnesses were terrific. They talked in plain language, not in legalese speak or things that would, you know, might be boring to the average listener. They made our founding fathers come to life, and their words come to life. And then the second half of the day, as you know, in the afternoon, we went through all these court cases from the 40s on. See, here's the thing, Raymond, that is clear to me. Congress or state legislatures would have never taken a vote to take prayer out of public school, would have never taken a vote to say you can't have a nativity scene, would have never taken a vote to say you have to bake a cake for anyone who comes in your door, even if it undermines your conscience and belief in your faith. it's all happened through the courts, Raymond. It's all happened by the courts, and particularly the Warren Court and Hugo Black in the 70s in the courts. They just took all of our religious liberty away, and now we're fighting to bring it back. Because if you lose religious liberty, Raymond, all the other liberties fall by the wayside quickly.
You lose everything. You lose speech. You lose the right to assemble. You lose everything. I just mentioned Bishop Robert Barron of Winona, yes. Rochester, the bishop there. He spoke of the secular attacks on religion. I'll play this and get your reaction.
There's a texture to the way religion is being attacked in our society. It's coming from a Renian philosophy that Josef Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, called the dictatorship of relativism. I'd call it the culture of self-invention, the complete prioritization given to individual autonomy, that we decide value, we decide meaning, we decide purpose.
Your thoughts on what Bishop Barron said there?
Well, first of all, he and I have become fast friends. He's just such a great guy, and I've really enjoyed the time I've spent with him. So if you think about it, Raymond, our founders could have taken the easy way and established a religion, and that's why the First Amendment is so important. They went the opposite way, and they really gave us this magnificent inheritance of you have the right to pray and worship as you choose, and we have lost that inheritance. So when you get back to this, many people have given up. Look, a lot of your viewers right now probably have questions. Where can I pray? When can I pray? Can I wear my faith symbol to work? Can the boss tell me to take it off? Can the homeowners association tell me to take my flag down for my faith? Whatever it is, people are confused in this country, and so they retreat. And so what he's really talking about, in my view, was we have taken away that individualism, those rights that our founders fought for and gave us, and we have to reclaim those.
Yeah, and rights given by God that the founders just carried on. I mean, they didn't even come from them.
Yes.
It came from God. These are divine gifts
came
and rights. One of the themes of the meeting was that distinction between freedom of worship and the free exercise of religion, that citizens should not only be able to worship as they wish within their churches, but also to be able to carry that faith into the public square without being attacked. Why is that distinction so important, Dan? And why does it often get lost when religious liberty is discussed?
So Rabbi Soloveitchik brought that up in one of his questions, because he said when we talk about the freedom to worship, that really means, well, okay, you can go worship as you wish in your church of your choice. But don't take it out. Don't exercise your religion outside of your church. So he really changed that in that question or his opening remarks. I forget where he said that. When he said it is not about the right to worship. It's about the right free exercise of your faith and to pray. And this commission, by the way, Raymond, that the president handed down an executive order on National Prayer Day on May 1st. Our charter is to advise the president and report to the president, which we will do after about 7 or 8 hearings about this time next year, and give him a report on what he can do in executive orders or maybe legislation he'll recommend to Congress to take up. But I think part of this will be, let's make sure we make that clear. The right to worship can actually be kind of a hidden thing to really keep your faith behind church doors.
Well,
and that's not what we want.
Another,
as Christians, we step outside of the doors.
Yeah, and Dan, every time this topic comes up, you hear, well, wait a minute, Jefferson and the founders insisted on a separation of church and state. Well, that separation was intended to keep the government from intruding into the church, not the other way around, not to exclude public expressions of faith in public.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was part of the testimony of one of our witnesses, that Hugo Black was the one who really brought that out in, I think it was a 1971 case where he took that and put it into the common discussion of the separation of church and state. And in my opening remarks, Raymond, you may remember, I said, look, let's just talk about faith communities. And America is, you know, look, we are still the strongest faith community in the world as a country for our Christian faith, and we respect all faiths in our country. But what do faith communities do? We have charitable hospitals. We help the poor. We help the drug and alcoholic addicted. We help mothers who have crisis pregnancies. We give more mm-hmm. money around the world to help people, you know, wherever it may be. The moral value of the faith community is powerful in this country. And why is it America is the only one that does that? I mean, think about it. We are the leader in that. We're only 6 or 7% of the world population, but we lead on those values, and it comes from our faith community. So yeah. It's when you look at what the founders did, it wasn't an accident. They designed the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They designed mm-hmm. it. The Declaration and the Bible are almost interchangeable. And that's why we have been blessed. Our last witness, Christian Wagoner from ADF, said something I thought was powerful. America is the last country in Western civilization that still defends religious liberty. Most of Europe has given it away already.
Yes, they have. And consequently, those governments and those societies are collapsing. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, during the meeting, voiced some criticism of the previous administration, which seemed to allow or even encourage attacks on religious liberty, mainly the persecution of and incarceration of peaceful pro-life activists, the infamous FBI investigation into traditional Catholics, and the shuttering of churches during COVID.
That faith was built into the foundation of our nation's founding documents. There was no mistake when it was included in the First Amendment. Our founding fathers understood that every individual must be free to worship without fear, without coercion, and without government interference.
Dan, how can the commission effectively protect one of the most sacred rights given to us by the Constitution, both on the federal and the local level?
Yeah. So, and the reason, of course, I've known Pam for a long time, and I just love her. She's the nicest person in the world, but also the toughest. She's a perfect attorney general for our country. But we actually serve under the Department of Justice as an agency. Our commission does. And so, one of the things that came out from our witnesses, because we asked our witnesses, what would you suggest to the president if you were in the Oval Office? And of course, again, this is the first of many hearings. And one is, to protect our religious liberty. First of all, the Supreme Court needs to take up more cases, and they need to quit kicking them back down to the lower courts, like this case we had against a Catholic school in Oklahoma, because we have an attorney general out there who just went against it, but it was a 4-4 vote. And I think a case like that will come back and we'll win that case of can you have money going into a charter school, et cetera, a private Catholic school. And so we have to get the courts at every level to take more cases on these big decisions. But on a lot of these cases, Raymond, the courts need to stay out of it. The courts need to stay out of it if there's not a general harm to the public. And so the courts have, again, since Trump came in 16, and again, his justices we've won the last 12 or 13 in a row, but we lost thousands that never got to the court, or thousands of cases at the lower levels to get to the court. So we've got a lot of work to do, but the courts need to do more work. The Supreme Court needs to quit kicking them back down. They need to take a stand. And we, as believers, Catholic, Protestants, Jews, any other faith folks in this country, we need to stand up and not give up the fight. Again, contend earnestly from the book of Jude. That's what he talked about. We contend earnestly, and that's what we have to do in this country, or we will lose this liberty, because most of this has happened by the courts, and we have to fight back strong.
Dan, very quickly, in addition to your new post as chair of this Religious Liberty Commission, you are the lieutenant governor of Texas. You led the Senate in passing legislation to end the teaching of critical race theory, DEI practices at universities, placing In God We Trust in the Texas Senate. But this was all done legislatively. Are you concerned that so many of these issues, particularly of faith, are handled via executive order? And what will the commission do to ensure that that's not the case in the future?
Well, you know, executive orders, depending who's writing them. I'm very happy with the executive order from the president for example, that created this commission, or the Faith Office. You know, this look, this president has used the name of Jesus more than any other president in history, I think, in the Oval Office. And to open up a Faith Office steps away from the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Faith Office, which is separate, but we work together with them, they are instituting these faith issues in all of our agencies. So can someone try to reverse that in the future? Of course. But whether it's an executive order or through congressional legislation or court decisions, we have to be in the fight. We can never let up. They gave the case of the cake baker where the gay couple wanted him to bake a cake, and he fought back. He's been in the Supreme Court now, the testimony was, for 13 years. He won one case and someone else sued him. He's moved to multiple states. But you know what? He is not giving up on his religious liberty. So we have to be very smart in government, and we have to be very smart about how we walk down this path with the president. But we have a president who believes in God, believes in Jesus Christ, and who has said, I want my government to reflect the values of where I know most of the country is. And again, if you choose not to believe, you choose not to believe. The great thing about America, you can have that choice, too, if you want.
Dan, among your legislative accomplishments in Texas, you expanded border security, including adding billions of dollars to increase border enforcement. Yes. Yesterday, a New York Post article read, and I'll read this to you, Border Patrol agents didn't release a single migrant into the U.S. last month, a staggering drop after the Biden administration allowed 62,000 illegal crossers into the country in May of 2024. Dan, tell us about the border situation in Texas now compared to a year or 2 years ago. Are you noticing any differences?
It's a massive difference. In fact, we were able to take about $3 billion back away from what we've been spending on the border to give more tax relief to Texans, because under Joe Biden, we had to spend billions and billions a year to protect our own state and protect America. Yeah, we were having thousands and thousands and thousands cross the border every day. I think yesterday is the lowest on record, 95 people. And our border with Mexico is the distance from Atlanta to Portland, Maine. That's how big our border is. So considering that we only had 95 people cross, Joe Biden sold our country out. And look, we should have legal immigration. No one should have to come to America in the back of an 18-wheeler and suffocate to death in 110-degree heat. No woman should have to be raped, or a young girl as part of the bounty to come here. We need legal immigration reform, and that has to be done. And I know you're short on time. Two other bills I want to tell you about this session that we passed. We put the Ten Commandments back in every classroom. It's a voluntary program. So if a church adopts a school or an individual or a business, they take a 16 by 20 copy framed of the Ten Commandments, and the schools are required to hang it. We've now opened up a cottage industry. We're starting to churn out the Ten Commandments everywhere. We're going to be taking them to schools. And we pass Senate Bill 11, which puts prayer back in public school to give you the time, if you wish to have private time, to pray. And of course, as you said, I put In God We Trust in the Senate as my first bill 17 years ago. And I put Under God in the state pledge. So when you give your life to God, you know, good things happen. And I'm so blessed and to be in this position. I'm so grateful to the president for asking me to chair this committee. It is the most important job I've ever been given, quite frankly.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, thank you for being here. Thank you for your time. And we will check in on the commission. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you, Raymond.
Thank you, my friend. Each day, Pope Leo XIV continues to offer us glimpses of where this pontificate is headed. Will he continue along the path Francis established, or is something new in the offing? Joining me now to discuss, the distinguished senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of the new book, Pomp, Circumstance, and Unsolicited Advice, Commencement Addresses and University Lectures. Please welcome back to the program, George Weigel. George, could you make the titles a little smaller so I could do them in one breath? My Lord, I'm glad I did Shakespeare in my early career, George. I would have never gotten through that book title. But I know it's graduation season, and I want to talk about the new book in a moment. But give me your thoughts on the Holy Father. You were there covering this election, the first American pope, obviously, but what of his first 6 weeks on the throne? What do they tell you about the direction of this papacy?
Raymond, I think we ought to give this man some time. I think he's very much his own man. He's demonstrated that the first night of his election by coming out on the central loggia of the Basilica, dressed as he was, which to me signified that he understood that the papacy has a character, and that it's inappropriate, if I may say, to impose your own personal idiosyncrasies on the office of Peter. He's continued to say things that I find heartening, his defense of the family, his defense of marriage, the fact that he said the other day that no state has the right to try to destroy another. That was important. He's had important talks with the head of the Ukrainian church, Major Archbishop Shevchuk, who I think feels understood in a way that perhaps he was not in the previous 12 years. The Pope's going back to Castel Gandolfo for summer vacation, so that swimming pool will get some use again. And despite the fact that he's a White Sox fan, no one is perfect, and the fact that he's a baseball guy is encouraging to me.
Yeah, yeah. A new poll, a Pew poll out this week, George, and I when I saw it, I said, we have to ask George about this. 47% of U.S. adults, according to the survey, have a personal or family connection to Catholicism. 20% of U.S. adults identify as Catholic. Half of those say they pray daily. Only 28% attend Mass weekly. 23% go to confession once a year. The survey also touched on Eucharistic practices, the importance of anointing the sick, the traditional Latin Mass, et cetera, et cetera. Key findings included 13% of Catholics say they've attended a traditional Latin Mass at least once in the last 5 years, including 2% who said they attend today weekly. George, what do you make of that survey, the results, the way they were measured and chopped and presented? And does this really tell us about the state of Catholicism in the U.S. now?
Well, these surveys are always somewhat blunt instruments, Raymond, as you know as well as I do. What apparently was not there was this quite striking reporting from many dioceses of largest numbers in years of people entering into full communion with the church at Easter or being baptized at the Easter vigil. Something that did not get sufficient comment when we were both in Rome 6 weeks ago was that there were 200,000 young people there for what they had hoped would be the canonization of Blessed Carlo Acutis. That's an interesting sign for the future. And I think it reflects the United States. There were a lot of those kids from the U.S., we're also living, as I think you and I have discussed before, in a kind of golden age of Catholic campus ministry in the U.S., all sorts of impressive growth in Catholic campus ministry, often in unexpected places. Texas A&M, North Dakota State, even, God help us, the Ivy League schools. There is some very interesting Catholic content being brought into those decayed institutions.
What's your take on this battle over the Latin Mass that we've been seeing, not only in the United States, George, but in parts of Europe, where bishops are moving using Traditionis Custodes, the Pope Francis era ban on the traditional Latin Mass? Why do you think they're moving with such haste, given the new pope has barely weighed in? He hasn't weighed in at all on this topic. I mean, is it appropriate to, when in the midst of a new pontificate, to just invalidate or try to stamp out a valid and licit rite of the Catholic Church?
I think it's imprudent at best, Raymond. On May 18th, I did 2 hours of television commentary on the inaugural public mass of Pope Leo, which was as full smells and bells as you can get. A week later, I was at a small parish in central Maryland, very lively congregation, in which the pastor, for some reason that I don't quite understand, really likes praise music. And I said to my wife as we were driving back to our log cabin, I said, in a week, I have gone from the highest of high liturgy to praise music. And somewhere in that vast terrain, there must be room for people who find spiritual nourishment with the 1962 Missal and the celebration of the Mass in Latin. It just doesn't make sense to say that's the only thing that's off the board. So I'm hoping that there will be some tempering of the, frankly, authoritarianism on this going ahead.
Okay. Pope Leo XIV continues to reference that one of your beloved contents, and I know a word that you hold so close to your heart. You probably are writing a book about this now. Synodality, George. The question of whether he's making a distinction between Francis's concept of synodality, or is he adjusting and shifting the definition? A Dominican priest posted something on X. I want to get your reaction to this. He said one of the ways that Pope Leo is quietly bringing about a return to normalcy is how he handles the issue of synodality. He uses the word, but he uses it in a way that he is simply redefines it as a synonym for communio ecclesiology. At a stroke, he just ended the nonsense. George, your thoughts. Is Pope Leo closing the wildly elastic notion that synodality, encompass some future governing mandate for the church?
Raymond, I saw that X post, too, and it struck me as a bit of an overreach. However, let me say this. During the General Congregations of Cardinals, prior to the election of Pope Leo, there was considerable discussion of this, and I got the sense that for many cardinals from the Third World in particular, all that synodality meant to them is somebody's listening to us, and that's good. That's fine. But as I said in an article I wrote from Rome during that period, synodality cannot mean that the Catholic Church is a Quaker meeting with 1.4 billion people. Just can't be true. Can't happen. Moreover, in this 1700th anniversary of the First Council of Nicaea, which gave us the creed we pray every Sunday, it's perfectly clear that some things in the Catholic Church are not up for discussion. You know, Arius is not back in play.
Let's hope
the heresy. Well, there may be Arians around, but the heresy was dealt with 1700 years ago. And let's admit
that. Yeah, well,
they're
new Arians, George. Yes. I mean, you still have cardinals going around. I can't believe we still have cardinals and bishops running around saying, oh, you know, if women were ordained, that would be a wonderful thing. This has been settled, guys. I mean, come on. The constant resurrection of these long dead ideas, and when you open the door, George, and say, well, we're just a listening church now, it does foster that kind of, you know, well, let's imagine whatever we want the Catholic Church to be.
I quoted the great Chesterton in something I wrote about this a few weeks ago when I said, to quote Chesterton, an open mind like an open mouth should close on something. And we know what those somethings are. They're in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Now, if synodality means giving a voice, particularly to these growing parts of the world church, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, which have embraced the Catechism in full and are growing like Topsy as a result, that's all to the good. But let's not pretend that everything is up for grabs, because it isn't.
Yeah. Let's talk about your new book, Pomp, Circumstance, and Unsolicited Advice, Commencement Addresses and University Lectures. It's a collection of commencement addresses, as the title mentions, but there's much more to it than that. You write the following, George. The Catholic Church invented what we know today as the university, beginning in the 11th century and accelerating at a rapid pace through the High Middle Ages. Catholic scholars and students gathered in Bologna and Paris, Oxford, Cambridge, Prague, Krakow, Salamanca, and other urban centers to engage in study, academic mentoring, and debate. George, I think it's safe to say there's not much debate going on in a lot of these elite universities, certainly here in the United States and around the world. Compare today's university experience to what you described there. What happened?
Well, what happened, Raymond, one way to describe what happened, is that the tether between faith and reason got cut, and reason, left to its own devices, begins to question itself and its capacity to get to the truth of anything. So suddenly we get your truth and my truth, but nothing called the truth. And then we have overprivileged little snowflakes shouting anti-Semitic genocidal chants on Columbia's campus. That's how you get there, by saying that there is no such thing as the truth, or as I quoted the former president of Harvard in that foreword, truth is an aspiration, not a possession. Well, I'm sorry, it is a possession. And it's not just that 2 plus 2 always equals 4 in the base 10 system. This is a diminishment of reason and its capacities. It's a diminishment of an understanding of the human person. I mean, we're built to be truth-seekers.
And collected wisdom. Yeah, collected wisdom and knowledge, and certainly the reservoir of faith and its role in all of this that is often omitted. And then the dogma that replaces it, George, is just what you talked about. Anti-Semitic slogans and hatred of people of certain faiths. And, I mean, it becomes gender ideology. Other ideologies and dogmas rush in to fill the void.
Well, I think Catholic higher education at its best provides a template for the reform of higher education in general. And that's one of the reasons I put this book together, to try to demonstrate that both through these commencement addresses and through lectures on various topics in university settings that I hope give some example of what a truth-seeking community can look like. Mm.
You write about our much-missed dear friend, Father Richard John Newhouse. You say this years ago, Father Richard John Newhouse used to wonder aloud when Harvard, having long ago jettisoned Christo et Ecclesia from its great seal, would go the full Pontius Pilate and put a question mark after Veritas on its heraldic self-identifier. But even so, keen an analyst of American culture's Father Newhouse, who died in 2009, might not have been able to imagine that truth would be replaced by, quote, the context beloved by critical theory and other forms of cultural Marxism. George, have these universities tipped over into their own version of reality, protected by the high wall of tenure, really untouchable from the outside or larger world?
Raymond, I think the most important thing for particularly parents to recognize out of this disaster that we've seen displayed since October 7th, the Hamas attack on Israel, the disaster on these campuses, is that it is not necessary for your son or daughter to go to a so-called elite school in order to make it in life. In fact, you're going to get a much more coherent education in a much less toxic environment in the kind of Catholic colleges and universities who were kind enough to invite me to give their commencement addresses over the past 20 years. A good, solid liberal arts education makes it possible for you to do anything. People need to understand that.
And the book is, in it, you chronicle some of your commencement addresses at various Catholic universities over the year. Several are featured here. What is your hope for these Catholic institutions, and how do they exemplify the renewal that I think you're calling other institutes of higher learning to embrace?
They exemplify, first of all, Raymond, the retethering of faith and reason. That's important. Mm-hmm. Secondly, virtually all of these schools have a significant core curriculum. There's some things that everybody studies and everybody tries to learn, so that there's some foundation on which real conversation, real debate, genuine dialogue, not just shooting snarky emails at each other, can be based. Third, I think these universities try to create a campus culture that is something other than decadent. And because decadence is not conducive to learning. Decadence is not conducive to learning at all. And a restoration of the notion that the university has some responsibility for the formation of students, the formation of souls and hearts, not just the education of minds, is essential to the reform of higher education in general. And Catholic colleges and universities can exemplify that at their best.
George, how do you lower the temperature of both the rhetoric, the explosive riotous anarchy that have consumed so many colleges and universities, where differing viewpoints are often shouted or imposed on other students, literally? Yeah. I mean, Trump has been trying to tie this to federal dollars, you know, to drive out what he calls the woke agenda at these schools. How effective is that?
I don't know. We'll have to see. I think if Columbia, Harvard, and other places that really went crazy 18 months ago had expelled students for behavior incongruent with, inconsistent with, a community of mutual respect and learning, a lot of this would have stopped very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that the unwillingness of university administrators to be the adults in the room has a great deal to do with the sorry condition in which a lot of these schools find themselves today.
George, what's the best advice you've ever given at a commencement or that you've heard? And what do you hope readers take from the book?
Well, I'm not sure it's the best advice, but certainly the soundest advice is something I quote in the book, where Conrad Hilton, the famous founder of the hotel chain, was asked, I think in a commencement context, Mr. Hilton, you have a broad experience of humanity. What advice do you have for the next generation? And Conrad Hilton thought a bit and looked at the interlocutor and said, please put the shower curtain inside the tub. That's a good life lesson.
Yeah, sometimes the practical advice is the best advice, George. The book is Pomp, Circumstance, and Unsolicited Advice, Commencement Addresses and University Lectures by George Weigel. It's available at bookstores everywhere and online. George, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Raymond.
At the end of every Arroyo Grande show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts, my interviewees answer an Arroyo Grande questionnaire. It's a probing set of questions that reveal personal, intimate, even spiritual details that I always find revealing. This week, we assembled a collection of some of the most fascinating responses. Up first, Jim Caviezel. Who's the person you most admire?
My wife.
Why?
She's my life. Pillar. It's not even enough to think about that. See, that was a bad question.
I'm starting easy.
I'm not good at these.
Who's the person you most despise?
I've forgiven him.
Another good answer. What is your best feature?
Feature?
Yeah.
Passion? Passion's
Christ. Passion.
Yeah, I thought feature.
No, not feature film. Being a smart ass. What's your best feature as a person, as an actor?
As a feature?
It can be anything. It could be a quality. It could be a physical trait. What's your best feature?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
You know what people would say? Your eyes.
They're older.
But that's probably what they would say is your best feature.
But they're smiling.
It depends on if you're the guy you just forgave or not,
when
I guess.
Irish eyes are smiling. Okay. You know how it goes. Well, yeah. They must be up to something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. What do you fear?
The first thing is Resurrection, the film.
Sure.
The greatest fear.
Really? What?
Oh, yeah. Anything could go on that. Well, you got to remember, though, it's was born to do. So, but greatest fear, I worry. My children, my family. You know, I'm a good husband, a good father. I'm not the best father I want to be. I'm not the best husband I want to be. You know, those are other things. Mm. But I do love them deeply.
What is the thing you know that no one else knows?
I've heard other actors say it before. You know, you're going to fail. You know, it might be a gift that you have, but you're always concerned about that. I just outwork everybody. I think that's a big thing, is I have to outwork them, and then the gift takes over from there.
What's your favorite book?
The one I'm doing right now is Screwtape Letters. It's the one I'm into.
It's a lot of fun. Well, it's a fun book, and it's very wise.
Well, it's very wise, but it's getting me ready for the resurrection.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
I'm really studying it. So I'm breaking it apart and going through it and getting into the thoughts of evil, you know, the antithesis of what I'm going to be playing. And there's something, how Jesus works is so simple. There's a reason why I'm doing it, and it's during Lent.
Yeah.
So I'm fasting. So even though you and I are going to go to a nice restaurant after this, I'm not going to have any wine.
Oh, okay. Well,
I gave it up
then for maybe Lent. We won't be going to dinner. What is your biggest regret?
I don't really have any.
You don't have a professional regret?
No.
A role you should have taken?
No, because there were reasons for it at the time. They've they worked out, but it wasn't for me. You know,
no regrets.
I would have had a major regret if I had not married my wife.
Karen.
That would have been, and that almost happened. You know, I threw it away, and my soul was enough pointed in the right direction where something from above said, you know, gave me a bit of a broken heart and said, she was in the plan for you.
Get back there, dummy.
And I did.
Lauren, rapid fire. Okay. Who is the person you most admire?
Oh, my gosh. I would say collectively my family, if that's okay.
Well, you surround yourself with them. I've seen you with them, and I love that. About
love it.
That's what I think keeps your spirit intact.
It is.
Because I've seen you in public settings and on tour. That family's always pretty close.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Who's the person you most despise?
That's a tough question. You told me not to dwell on it. I don't have, there's like not one person that I can say I despise. That's.
I could think of one, but I'm not going to bring her up. Anyway.
I would love to have a conversation.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to talk about that off camera. What is your best feature?
Oh, maybe my, oh gosh, that's tough. I would say my, I don't know what this one word would be, but my desire to relate to anybody and everybody.
Oh.
What would that?
Accessibility.
Accessibility.
Empathy.
Empathy. Empathy.
What's your worst feature?
Empathy.
There's a double-edged sword again.
Yes.
Your favorite book and the last one you read?
Okay, last one I read was called Miracle on Voodoo Mountain. It's about this woman from Lafayette,
wow.
Moved to Haiti, started this during the earthquake. Incredible story. Very simple read. Really good. Miracle on Voodoo Mountain. It's because when we were at that event, I met one of the lawyers for the Human Trafficking Division of the White House. And I was like, this is incredible to see the work that is done. Her story kind of weaves into that tapestry a little bit. It was really beautiful to me. So I find myself compelled by those stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then your
favorite
question,
book.
Favorite book. Okay. This is a favorite book for nostalgia's sake, if we can do that.
Okay. We can do nostalgia.
Where the Red Fern Grows.
Oh, Where the Red Fern Grows.
And the
grows.
Reason why is because it's the first book I cried to. I remember laying in bed. I would read it every single night with my mom. We would read chapter after chapter. I just loved that book as a kid. And I remember looking, reading the book and having to pause for a moment and us looking at each other. Tears are coming down
my
face.
Why do you think it touched you that way?
Friendship and seeing loss, real loss. For what a child can understand even in that moment. Yeah.
The entire Arroyo Grande Show, the questionnaire edition, is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Look, you will get such insights into everybody from Jim Caviezel to David Mamet to Lauren Daigle. Really fun and insightful. And look, subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande Show episode. And we have a new prayerful posse coming up this Friday. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all the links. Tensions in the Middle East between Israel and Iran intensified this past week. Iran is refusing to surrender or halt its nuclear aspirations. Will the U.S. get directly involved with its own strike on Iran? And is a regime change even possible? With analysis, I'm joined by defense and counterterrorism analyst John Rossomondo. John, thank you for being here. Your thoughts on this escalation of the past week. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee's warning Americans to evacuate by air and sea as the crisis intensifies. There are now reports that senior U.S. officials are prepping for some kind of attack on Iran in the coming days. I have to say I'm troubled by all this talk of regime change because it never worked, John. Hussein, Gaddafi, the Shah of Iran in 1953. You call this republicanism. What does that mean?
Well, republicanism means putting a government that is supposedly elected and that has no internal legitimacy. I was out in front in 2003 with Karl Rove against our invasion of Iraq because I knew it wouldn't work. But in Iran, you have Reza Pahlavi, the son of the former Shah, who polls from like 2022 says enjoys better than 80% approval. So there's a legitimacy factor there. And he came out the other day saying that.
Yeah, don't get ahead of me, John. I'm going to go there in a minute. Hold on. I want to play that for the audience. Let's talk about the conflict first and then what might happen here. But I'm worried, though, about the talk of regime change, no matter who it is. But what would it mean for the greater conflict if the U.S. takes an active role alongside Israel and hits Iran?
Well, what it would mean if the U.S. were to get involved, it would mean the end of Iran's nuclear program, because you have the Fordow plant where they've been enriching uranium that only the United States has the capability of resolving. But then you would possibly have, Iran has agents inside the U.S. They could do something. Mm-hmm. The Iranians could close the Strait of Hormuz. I think that there's a lot going on here, and it's really something that, the Israelis have air supremacy, but the Iranians still have a lot of missiles and can do a lot of damage.
Hmm. Israeli officials say Iran has used a multi-warhead missile, a cluster bomb, to strike greater target areas, including hospital and civilian centers, as this conflict intensifies. While Israeli Prime Minister, he continues to say, Benjamin Netanyahu, they are focusing on strategic targets, particularly nuclear facilities. What are you hearing about the military focus of each side at this moment? And do you buy the information we're being given? We're all getting at this point.
Well, I buy the information that we're getting, but I've also heard that the Israelis have been less than strategic in terms of, where they've been bombing in Tehran. There have been civilian collateral damage. They've been going after regime assets. But I spoke with an Iranian defense analyst earlier today who said that the one agent that could change the regime, the regular military, has been hurt in terms of its air assets. And at the same time, the Iranians are targeting apartment buildings and using these cluster bombs to, create more havoc.
Mm. The President Trump, is considering the use of direct U.S. strikes on Iran. Now, critics of U.S. involvement, John, would say Iran poses no direct threat to the United States or the U.S. homeland, so why get involved? But I want to start with the threat posed by Iran. Do you believe that it poses a threat to the United States?
Well, the Iranian intelligence is involved with the drug cartels. Iran backs Venezuela, which has sent Trende Aragua, that President Trump's been talking about. You have Hezbollah assets inside the United States. And let's not forget that the Iranians sent a hit squad against President Trump last year,
right,
according to the Justice Department.
Yeah. Well, President Trump, despite that, and yes, you remember the Biden administration said that there were hit squads of targeting President Trump, then candidate Trump. But the president has insisted he doesn't want the U.S. to get involved in a shooting war with Iran, while at the same time insisting that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. On Wednesday, President Trump was asked about an exchange with President Macron of France during the G7. And this was about regarding a possible ceasefire with Iran. The president responded this way.
You had a bit of a row with President Emmanuel Macron of France the other day, the G7,
no,
it sounded like.
He's a nice guy. Look, he said I was going back home to make a ceasefire. Not a ceasefire. We're long beyond ceasefire. And I said, why do you say that? Why would you say ceasefire? It's a bad term to use. because a ceasefire means like everything's going swimmingly, we'll take a little time off. It's not. We're not looking for a ceasefire. We're looking for a total, complete victory. Again, you know what the victory is. No nuclear weapon.
Now, John, your thoughts on that exchange. I mean, is the president basically saying that U.S. involvement is inevitable, particularly when Iran's refusing to surrender or give up its nuclear capability?
Well, that's certainly on the table. I mean, President Trump would like the Ayatollah to back down, but, they've been telegraphing for a long time that they have no interest in giving up their enrichment program, which is Trump's red line. I think the Israelis are more than capable of handling it militarily, but, you know, back in the 1980s, Reagan sank half the Iranian Navy. You had, strikes against Gaddafi and then strikes against Iraq by the Clinton administration. We're only talking about a very limited U.S. role. The Israelis can handle the bulk of it.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah al-Khamenei, rejected U.S. calls for surrender in the face of these blistering attacks by Israel. And he warned that any military involvement by the Americans would cause irreparable damage to them. John, should we expect to see some kind of strike on U.S. installations or here at home should the U.S. get involved in this thing and actually engage us?
Well, the United States has withdrawn a lot of forces from Al Udeid, which is our main air base in Qatar. You have reports of, blood being brought to the Middle East to deal with these attacks. And also, the U.S. fleet has been taken out of Manama, Bahrain, to be out of range. So we're taking precautions. And I would not also rule out Iran putting its sleeper agents into action on U.S. soil.
Mm. You think that's the most likely retaliation, not an attack, necessarily a military attack, but a domestic terrorism event?
Well, you'd probably possibly see both. I mean, just like we saw the Iranians use missiles against U.S. troops when President Trump killed Qasem Soleimani in 2020. You'd see something similar against U.S. bases. And our Gulf allies are terrified of Iran targeting them for being allied with the U.S.
Okay, so what in your estimation would be the best approach for the U.S. to take here? Trump keeps talking about a deal. I mean, you would prefer to see the U.S. employ its intelligence forces in a more clandestine way in Iran with no direct involvement. What would that look like?
Well, it would look potentially like President Reagan's use of, the CIA with Solidarity, and back in the 1980s. Mm. When Reagan was working with John Paul II. It would, Reagan and the CIA provided fax machines to a Solidarity that ultimately brought an end to communism. It would, include providing organizational capabilities to the anti-regime opposition led by Prince Reza Pahlavi. It would include Starlinks. They're talking about sending thousands of starlings into Iran. I mean, those are things that it would look like. So that way you have the Iranian people informed and able to take matters into their own hands. And then you would also potentially have the Israelis intervening.
Yeah, well, we saw with the Green Revolution years ago when Barack Obama had an opportunity, when there were uprisings in Iran, and we kind of missed the opportunity there. But that civil society, it seems they're still very unhappy. But let's talk about that for a moment. You have the exiled crown prince of Iran, Reza Pahlavi. And he, by the way, who lives in Virginia. He's been in the D.C. area for many, many years.
Maryland.
He issued this statement.
میهنانم. جمهوری اسلامی به پایان خود رسیده و در حال سقوط است. آنچه آغاز شده برگشت‌ناپذیر است. تنها یک خیزش همگانی لازم است تا این کابوس برای همیشه باشد که به زودی در کنار شما باشم.
John, your thoughts on the role of the exiled Iranian royal family here. Is the Islamic regime in as dire straits as he's portraying? And is there a chance that Pahlavi could be restored to the throne? And would that bring stability?
Well, I think that, first of all, the regime's grip is getting tenuous, especially due to the Israeli strikes and rumors that the Ayatollah himself is on Netanyahu's target list. But, you know, he provides the same sort of symbolism that maybe John Paul II provided for Poles during the dark days of communism. And the Iranian people are tired of this regime. I spoke with an Iranian friend who spoke with somebody inside the country, and that friend was like, well, I'd love to raise a statue of Netanyahu in Tehran. I mean, if you look at the fact that 1,000 Iranians have signed up with the Mossad, that says a lot about the influence of the regime. People in Iran want it gone, and we just need to help them to tip it over like we helped in 1989 bring down communism.
Yeah, there is an historic precedent for return to power, but very few. In Spain in 1975, Francisco Franco died, and then the deposed Prince Juan Carlos was installed as king. He was an absolute monarch for a few years, and then he transitioned to a democracy. Pahlavi has said in the past that should he return, he'd be like Juan Carlos. John, are we about to see a similar moment?
I think that if we can help the people of Iran free themselves from the besieged militia that oppresses them, maybe the Israelis can do that. We would end up seeing him talking. There's been talk about the regular army officers talking with Reza Pahlavi about restoring him to the throne and recognizing him. Way that the army recognized the Ayatollah back in 79. So there is a very strong possibility of that happening.
But the Persians are only a very bare, I think they have a bare majority there, right? It's like 51%, just over half are Persians. Everybody else is Islamic. So don't you have the same tensions at play?
Well, you do have tensions between the Persians, the Baluchis, Kurds, other minorities. But if you have somebody like Reza Pahlavi, who's spent decades in the U.S., learned from our system, I think that he can bring these disparate groups together to build a parliament, to do what Juan Carlos did, to build a multi-ethnic, multi-party system in Iran that will bring peace and end Iran's involvement in violence and terrorism.
Mm. Why do you think Trump is giving himself this open window where he says, I'll make a decision in the next few weeks? That was just announced today about whether to strike Iran directly or not.
Well, there's a lot of deliberation going on over, say, striking Ford out, because there's internal DOD assessments that said that maybe the 30,000-pound bunker buster might not do the job. So he also is somebody who wants to be sure that if he does it, you're going to have what we call the bang for the buck. And he also probably wants to keep the Iranians guessing.
Hmm. We will leave it there, John. The Arab Spring Ruse by John Rosamondo is available at bookstores everywhere and online. John, thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.